Grafina step up and disorder it and do it a bit more realistically. But before that, I feel I owe you some things from yesterday. So let me, first of all, we had a bit of a rush in the end when we discussed the zigzag edges. And I just wanted to show you that actually these edge states can be seen in experiment. And what I have here, I don't know if experiments are exciting for you because we're in a theoretical world here. But this is actually something that I love about condensed matter. You do something, you can test it, or somebody else can test it. And sometimes it makes our theory, the lifetime of the theory much shorter because it gets killed right away. But sometimes you get to explain something that really happens, which I think is wonderful. So what I want to show you, and maybe you should just pass it around, is a nano ribbon of graphene, which is somewhat curved. So it's almost on the way to be a nanotube. So actually, a precursor of graphene was nanotubes, and it's still an active field. But it's a very, very short, long and narrow strip of graphene, and it has two edge states on each edge. And what you'll see in the graph that I'm giving you is the density of states. So the density of states that is measured is not quite as nice and like graphene that you, I think, did yesterday in tutorial. But so let's say this is density of states. This is the zero Dirac point. This is the energy. The density of states might look like that. But if we have edge modes at zero energy, there might appear a peak here. And actually, in the picture, the graphene is not that clean, and there's a little gap open. And if you have two edge states, they might talk to each other if the ribbon is pretty narrow. And when they talk to each other, the peak might actually split to two peaks. And this is something you can see in the picture there. So this is one thing. Another thing that I didn't emphasize about partial Fourier transforms is when we partially Fourier transform, we have to be, yeah.
I will talk about it a little bit. This is an STM experiment. I showed you ARPES, which is one favorite of theorists. STM is another favorite. STM basically is a sharp tip that has an atomically sharp tip.
It stands for what?
It stands for scanning tunneling microscopy or spectroscopy. And the tip is placed above a sample, and there's some bias voltage. And then, through the vacuum, electrons can tunnel from the tip into the let's say, our graphene sample. And it turns out that the derivative, the IDD curve of this experiment is proportional to the density of states at that point in the tip. So what this experiment does is actually measures the local density of states. So not only the sum of all of the eigenstates that have that energy, but also that have amplitude at that particular point where the tip is pointing. And we'll talk about more about the capabilities of STM. And again, this is something that measures something that is so easy to calculate and to usually the zeroth order, it gives very nice agreement with the simplest picture possible. When it doesn't, then it's interesting also. And another thing I wanted to say is just about the periodicity, the Brillouin zone when you partially Fourier transform. So before, when we fully Fourier transform graphene, this is our Brillouin zone. When we partially Fourier transform, we have to be careful. If I have graphene and I Fourier transform in this direction, the x direction, for the zigzag edge, the periodicity is this vector. Okay? Because it doesn't matter if I'm here or here, I always do this when I do this step, I see the same thing. So if this vector is A, the periodicity is minus pi over A to pi over 3. But here I actually have 4 pi over 3 and minus 4 pi over 3, and pi is more or less here, pi minus pi. So basically, if you want to make sense of the two-dimensional Bredouin zone and the one-dimensional Bredouin zone, you have to rearrange. And as you know, the Bredouin zone is not the only unit cell that you can choose. And you can shift anything you want by a reciprocal lattice vector. So for example, I can take this little piece and shift it exactly by a reciprocal lattice vector, and that will fill up this piece. And I can make a rectangular Bredouin zone. And then, if I look at the projection on the kx direction, I have my minus pi to pi, one-dimensional Bredouin zone. And there is two projections, one for k prime and one for k. And the way I drew it before, the edge states were actually here. So they are between the k and k prime if I actually draw it from 0 to 2 pi. Okay, so the picture that is shown in all of the papers is that, basically. In this notation that we used before, the Dirac cones are here, and the edge states are between them. So of course, this point and this point are equivalent. You can always shift things by 2 pi in the kx direction. So this is one thing from yesterday. If you have questions about that, that would be your time. And another thing that you mentioned, what's your name?
Bruno.
That Bruno mentioned was that he heard that the Klein paradox is actually when you get
larger than 1. Okay, so I looked yesterday in some papers, and actually there's some mix-up with notations and all of that. But the main idea is that if you drive a current through a Dirac system or a Klein-Gordon system, which we're not talking about in this course, you might measure a current that looks like it's bigger than the one you started with. But there are two differences between what we did yesterday and this situation. So first of all, we were measuring things outside of a barrier. Outside of the barrier, you can never measure something that is more than 1. T and R are both smaller than or equal to 1. Inside the barrier, you might, but only for a massive Dirac case. So if I start with a wave here and I go into here, and I'm in the Klein regime where the energy here is positive, the energy here is negative, or the barrier is higher than the rest mass. So you can work it out for yourself or come to see me and see that in the massless Dirac, when you start from a wave that propagates here, and you have an electron, you'll actually end up with a wave that propagates in the opposite direction, but it's actually a hole. So in terms of current, the current still flows that way. In the massless Dirac case, this will be actually the only contribution, but the amplitudes will be the same. So it will be perfect transmission, but no amplification. In the massive case, there is amplification. So if you want to see details, we won't waste time on it now, but you can come and I'll show you. Okay. And let's change gears and start talking about impurities. So we talked about breaking the translational symmetries of graphene, but actually we can always look at that breaking of symmetry also as a perturbation especially when it's local. And today we're going to talk about a local perturbation. So we saw before that you can impose boundary conditions on the edge, and you'll generate some interesting physics. You can also impose zero-dimensional boundary condition. And that's how I want to look at the impurity. It's like I have waves everywhere. Everything is fine, but there's some boundary condition somewhere. So at the extreme case, I'm going to think of a huge potential somewhere, just at a point in real space, that my waves scatter off. They just don't want to be stuck there. And before that, I have to introduce Green's functions in condensed matter. So are you familiar with propagators, Feynman diagrams, stuff like that? So I saw also that in John's course, you did draw many diagrams, but you didn't call them propagators or anything. And I'm sure you did it many times to calculate, cross-sections of scattering and stuff. In condensed matter, we also use Green's functions. And I'll just briefly, T minus T prime, I'll just briefly define and not more than that. So basically what I'm thinking about is adding an electron to the system somewhere and in some state. So let me denote that state by alpha. It could be a momentum state. It could be a position somewhere. It could be a certain spin, certain chirality, whatever. But it doesn't actually have to be an eigenstate of the system. And then I extract an electron, could be of the same state or a different state, at a later time. And I call that the retarded Green's function. Of course, I can have the opposite, which would be called the advanced Green's function. Usually, time here is Fourier transformed. So usually, I can think of frequency domain, which would basically correspond to energy. And this alpha, beta, the easiest thing to work with if we have indeed translational invariance would be to just put momentum here. I left them open. So it could be a spin, it could be momentum, or position, for example.
And there's only half the different.
It could be, sublattice, pseudo spin. So this is still pretty general. Today we're going to talk either on momentum or position, and we're going to take, let's say, same spin. And position could be either on A or B in our case. And there is also equation of motion. For the Green's function that you can derive, which basically tell us already what this will look like. So for any Hamiltonian in any Hilbert space, I can define it as a matrix in my Hilbert space. And then I have this matrix equation, and I can Fourier transform it, and I can get h bar omega minus the Hamiltonian is equal to 1. So I Fourier transformed the time. Okay? And I get that, and I know, there's a G. HG, yeah. So I know already that my matrix, and it's going to be a matrix in the same Hilbert space, is just h bar omega minus h, where h is defining the Hilbert space to the minus 1. Okay, and I guess you've used that before. Yeah.
How did you derive it? Where does it come from? What's the starting point to derive the equation of motion for the creature?
You can either go from the definition. You can go from the definition, basically. I can give you a reference to some better derivation. But basically, if you define g like that, then you should know how to take derivatives. And you can take one of these to, let's say, t prime to 0. And then you take a derivative, and you know how to take a derivative of an operator. You just do a commutation relation with Hamiltonian.
What stands for green function are the Heisenberg operators. So you can use this definition and take straightforwardly the derivative with respect to one of the time, keeping the other fixed.
Okay. So then, but actually, especially in condensed matter, a huge matrix in the full Hilbert space, especially when we're thinking of many-body systems, is totally useless. So imagine that I have 10 to the 22 sites, and then I want to put electrons on these sites. My Hilbert space could be all of the configurations, and of course I have to take care of minus signs because they're fermions. So I'll take Slater determinants. This is totally useless. However, in certain cases, I can use this. And the certain cases are when I have a Hamiltonian that I know how to diagonalize. For example, when it's not interacting, then I don't have to look at all of the configurations. I can look at a single particle because I know that everything just adds up. If I want to calculate something, I calculate it for one particle, and then I have to fill up states according to the energy, start with the lowest one. And, of course, when I have symmetries, so if I have translational symmetry, I'll write this in the basis of momentum, single particle momentum, and then I know exactly what I'll get. So my G is going to be H omega minus epsilon K. So this is when I have just a Fermi liquid to the minus 1. I didn't put here, but actually to solve that in time domain, I have to add a little imaginary piece to my frequency to make everything converge at very long times. So that would be, so the Green's function is going to be H omega minus epsilon K plus I delta. So this I delta basically tells you that it's the retarded Green's function. If you go back to time, at very, very long time, this will just cause an exponential decay. But this could be infinitesimally small. We also have the advanced Green's function is when we change the sign here. So we can either look at states where we insert an electron and then check to see what happens with it, or we can do the opposite. We can extract an electron and then put it back and see how well it fits back in. So these are two probes, and many of the things that we're going to look at are basically imaginary times of Green's functions or some combinations of Green's functions. And when I say imaginary part, I just mean that you take the retarded minus the advanced. I don't mean take blindly imaginary part of any function you see, but just do this procedure of taking first the Green's functions with the plus I delta and then minus the Green's function with the minus I delta. So for example, the density of states. Let's say I want to calculate the density of states at a particular point R. So I call that the local density of states, L dos. At a point R and energy omega. So I'm just going to do it in energy right away. So what I want to do is insert a particle at point R and extract it at point R. And I want to do it, you know, in different times and then Fourier transform in time. But actually, sorry, I need to add in here. What actually gives me the density of states is 1 over pi, the imaginary part of this. So you can see that immediately in this. So if I take a clean system, then minus 1 over pi of the imaginary part of the Green's function is the imaginary part of this, which is proportional to delta of epsilon of whenever my energy is epsilon of k. So this would be the density of states at omega. And of course, I have to sum over all momentum if I want to get it. And more than that, I showed you ARPES before that measures the spectral function. You don't even have to sum over k. There are some things that even give you not only how many states you have at each energy, but which k's they come from. And this is ARPES, ARPES experiment, because I told you that you shine light, an electron is emitted, but you can measure not only the energy of the electron, but also where it comes from in momentum space. Good idea. And another thing I want to say is, what is this averaging? So in a clean system, if I'm interested in just things at zero temperature, which is mostly what we do in this course, but sometimes you want more than that, what this is actually expectation value over the ground state. And the ground state could be a many-body ground state that we don't easily deal with. But what we can do is some perturbation theory. We can start with the non-perturbed ground state, and then we have this G, which is for the clean system, non-perturbed. And then we can add whatever perturbation, either interactions or impurities like we're going to have today, and we can expand this G in these terms. And I think you'll see that the Feynman diagrams that describe whatever processes are pretty intuitive. You can think of a singular electron, and you're allowed to do that because we already defined what is a single electron, even though the system might be interacting or might be in a very convoluted state. But you can think of a single electron going in because you inserted it, experiencing something in this medium, which is a many-body medium, and then you extract it out and see what is the effect on it. Any questions? Yeah.
Feynman diagrams techniques, they work with Feynman propagators, not with dialogue or transfer.
They work with these just as well. There is formalism to do all of that. We do many things in condensed matter. We actually have not just retarded and advanced Green's functions, we have imaginary time Green's functions, which I didn't mention, but when you have temperature, you can actually not do that expectation value on the ground state, but do an average, and I think this is how Feynman started looking at systems like that. But you can think of the time as, sorry, you can think of a thermal average. And then usually what you want to calculate is a partition function, and it will be an average over time, and you can write it as e to the minus beta and some free energy. But then you see already that you can do perturbation theory on the free energy. And the time there would just be, would actually be an imaginary time because you don't have I here. So beta is the temperature. So you can think of that as some I tau, some I time. And you can take the same formalism as you did with Feynman diagrams before and use it for these imaginary time Green's functions. You can also do that with these retarded and advanced. There's also another kind that puts the retarded and advanced together that's called time-ordered Green's functions. And I think that's more similar to what you used before. And what else did I want to say? And you can basically apply very similar reasoning. Today I'm going to be somewhat sloppy about notations and all of that. You have to maybe convince yourself that, you know, the rules work just the same. You need to look at the Hamiltonian and derive the rules. Sometimes I would even take this omega plus I delta and call it I omega, just because it sometimes makes things look nicer. I don't need to carry this. So it's called an analytic continuation. And I can work with this I omega, and whenever I want to get back to the retarded, I do this. Or if I want to get back to the advanced, I put a minus sign here. So so that's possible. Okay, any more? Okay, so now let's think about an impurity. And just a little aside, in John's class, you talked about conductivity going something like E squared tau over M, N E squared tau over M, right? And this came from some Drude model where you had a random force acting on your particles. And this tau basically was sort of the time it takes between collisions, the time that things can propagate. And you basically don't know where this tau comes from. And I think that you mentioned interactions, you mentioned disorder, you mentioned phonons. So many things contribute to this tau. And actually, this tau, it's just some collective name to all of our ignorance of what's happening in the system. And it's usually considered as something that is just making things not as nice, not as clean, and all of that. I'm going to take actually the opposite point of view today. I'm going to show you that sometimes the fact that you have an impurity, except for, you know, adding it up to this tau, can also give you some information that you don't see otherwise. And I'm talking especially about these STM experiments where you tunnel into a certain point, but you take into account that somewhere in your space there is an impurity. So let me just think that I have a clean graphene, except for, let's say, an impurity here. And then I tunnel. So I put some bias, H bar omega here, so that my electrons would want to tunnel somewhere. And then I let them do whatever they want in the sample, and they might scatter off of the impurity and come back. Of course, if everything is clean, then there's not much to see in terms of interference. But if I go to the impurity and come back, I should see some interference of waves. And I think this is where it becomes interesting. Now, is this case realistic? Maybe not so much, because you usually have a landscape of impurities. But if you think that you might have a dilute array of impurities, then your tip might be pretty close to one, but maybe far from others. And maybe by the time you get to an impurity that's far away, your wave function is not coherent anyways, and there's no chance it's going to even contribute anything to the wave packet that comes back. So it is a good approximation to some degree. And if I want to draw, you know, a certain diagram, then I'm thinking of something that starts with some k of omega, scatters by, let's say, v of q, and then leaves with g of k minus q in omega, something like that. Or in real space, which may be more intuitive,
let's say I have an impurity at R naught, so I have G of R minus R naught and T, and say omega, I'll always work at frequency domain, and then I'll have G R naught minus some R prime and omega, and if I want to measure density of states, I will take R prime equals to R. So I already talked about the perturbation, but let me just make it more rigorous. So basically, what I want to say is that G of R and R and omega. So the reason I put a comma here and I put a minus sign here is actually because I already know something about the system. So for the clean system, I know that there's translational invariance. So there might be a dependence on if I do this experiment of putting an electron and extracting it, there might be a dependence on the distance I let it propagate. But there shouldn't be any dependence on where I do this experiment in my sample. Everything should be translational invariant. So if I take my putting position and extracting position and move it, should be the same. So actually, the Green's function is a function of the distance. But in a general system without a translational invariance, I can write it this way. And what I want to do is basically write a perturbation expansion. So it's going to be R minus, let's say, R prime, plus G naught of R minus some R naught, V of R naught, G of R naught minus R prime, and so on. So I can do this many, many times. Now, for a single impurity, you can even sum up an infinite series. But for today, we'll do the Born approximation, which would be basically cutting it here. And let me just denote by G naught the clean system. Okay, so I could also write maybe a recursive equation where I just put G here, the total Green's function, and that will generate the rest of the terms. Okay, because I can the next term would be to scatter once, and then to go to another impurity state, scatter again, and another Green's function. But I just cut it here. And the second thing I want to do is, since I would like to look at the local density of states, I want to make R and R prime equal. So I just have this, basically. So now, before I go on to actually calculate it, I also want to say that these are all matrices in R notation. If you had a Fermi liquid, this would just be some number, but we have that AB sublattice complication, so we have matrices, and sometimes you have matrices in spin. I want to say what will happen when you Fourier transform. So let's say that for some odd reason, I want e to the I QR of this G of RR and omega. And I want to Fourier transform all of that. Then what you'll find is the following. You'll find G naught of K and omega delta of say 0 and omega, delta of Q equals 0. Because if you think about it, the clean system should not give me anything except that Q equals 0. It's uniform. The density of states that comes out of this system does not have a Fourier transform except for the 0. It's just a uniform density of states. Plus, what you'll find here, if you do this, is that you get a convolution. So you will get basically V of Q. So now I Fourier transform both these and two of them, and just already did the calculation. So sum over K, G of K and omega, okay, maybe I should put V here because it might be a matrix. G of K minus Q of omega. So in the Born approximation, you see that this does not depend on K. So I can take it out except that it's a matrix. So let's just think of having an impurity on one of the sides. Let's say I have it on A, the A sublattice. And VQ is just going to be the Fourier component of this. Now, this has two terms. VQ, the Fourier component of what my impurity might look like, is just an envelope function to this quantity, which I call gamma of Q, which is totally a quantity of the clean system. It only involves the clean system's Green's function. So basically, there's some interference going on that is induced by the impurity. And I can see this interference only if I have that V of Q. Now, V of Q itself, if you think of a delta function impurity, V of Q is just going to be a constant. So it's not going to even do anything to the quantity we measure. But if you would think about something like a Gaussian, for example, then V of Q is only also going to be a Gaussian. Yeah?
Which is inside this?
It's a matrix, so I put 1, 0, 0, 0. So this is only for the case of graphing, I have to tell you what is this perturbation V doing in AB sublattice space. So I'm just saying that I'm putting an impurity only on the A sublattice. If I would look at the Hamiltonian, I would have H naught plus the perturbation, and I would put something like that.
Let's say R equals R naught, some matrix, which would be put the impurity only on the A sublattice of that particular unit cell. Okay, so that would be my perturbation as I write it in the Hamiltonian. And from this, VQ is derived. But the matrix doesn't change. It comes from the fact that I'm in AB sublattice space, that I wrote everything in AB. If I want to do that, I have to specify how my perturbation is acting in this space. So I want to take a simple case where I just put a single impurity on a single site, so this is a delta function perturbation, a single site, and it's not enough to say that I'm in, you know, this certain unit cell. I also have to tell you that I'm only taking A, so it's like CA R equals 0, CA R equals 0. Okay? So I just wrote it this way because everything is written this way. I want it to be compatible with the rest, with the Hamiltonian. But before we go to graphene, let me just tell you what this might look like when you think of a Fermi liquid. So let's say I'm probing a certain energy. And remember, the STM tip, you can control the energy with the bias voltage. And I want to probe graphene. I want to probe not graphene, but a Fermi liquid. So let's say I have a circular dispersion, and I have a circle of Fermi surface. So if this is omega, this is the energy that I chose. I have particles all around here, and they can be in any k that gives me that epsilon of k is equal to omega. That defines the circle. Of course, There might be some other states that are not as well defined and all of that, but to first order approximation, these are the states that are going to contribute. And they can scatter from anywhere on this circle to anywhere else, because my impurity will conserve the energy. I'm not thinking of an impurity that can be excited. You can add that as well, but for now, just an impurity like that. But it does not conserve momentum because it breaks the rotation, the translational symmetry. So there are many processes, but actually, the largest process that can happen is this process, and it's actually the strongest one. The process that takes you from a certain k to k plus pi. This is the strongest process, and it just this is because of some phase-based arguments. So basically, if you take something like dk, and you take omega minus epsilon k plus I delta, and omega minus epsilon k plus q plus I delta, and you want to satisfy these two, and let's say roughly they look like delta functions, then basically you will find that your result is peaked. Let's say lambda of q is going to be my result. In this case, it's going to be peaked in q. And the q that it's peaked at is the q such that epsilon of q equals 2 omega. It's this vector. Sorry, actually, that's for, that's fine. Is that okay? So all of the points here, their energy, epsilon k here is equal to omega, and epsilon k here is equal to omega. Let's say this is k minus q. And this vector is such that it's connecting to. If I had a linear dispersion, then this would be k equals omega, and this would be, again, k equals omega, and this would be just 2 omega. Okay? Yeah.
That's which one? K-plane, no?
Which line?
That circle is in the K-plane.
Yeah,
here
so, okay.
Graphene?
This is not graphene. Okay. This is not graphene. I'm just talking about a Fermi liquid that has, this is momentum space, and it has some dispersion. But I know, let's say that it even has k squared over 2n dispersion. Okay? Whenever I slice it, when I decide on an energy, it will give me a circle, like the Fermi surface. That, you know, I can choose any energy. But it will give me a circle just because it's circularly symmetric. We can even assume that, you know, omega is equal k to make it easier. Okay? For some reason. But now I'm asking, what are the scattering processes that actually contribute to this? So I have g of k of omega and g of k minus q. But what I'm trying to say is that when you look at the Green's function, you have these factors. Okay, and these factors are strongly peaked when both energies are exactly omega. So I can have scattering processes from anywhere on the circle to anywhere else. But the strongest process is the one that takes me all across the diameter. That's all I'm trying to say. Yeah.
Okay. You said that's for like regular dispersion relation. But we have direct from it.
Right.
But it's so the same thing?
It's not exactly the same thing, but it's there's one part of it that is the same. The fact that it's strongly peaked on a circle is the same. And that will affect the fact that I expect to find a dispersion like that, q equals 2 omega here. I expect to find a peak at q equals 2 omega. In fact, it doesn't really happen in graphene, and that's because of chirality. So I'm going to show you that in a second. But this is true in the Fermi liquid. The vector that connects the two furthest away points on the contour of constant energy is the place where this function lambda of q is going to peak. And this lambda, the imaginary part of this lambda is q, is the local density of states, or the modulations in the local density of states. We have a local density of states that is, you know, not dependent on space, and we have an additional piece that is due to the impurity, the correction. And the correction is going to be peaked at this vector. Yeah.
And that bottom line.
This one?
Yeah, that one.
Okay. So what I did here is I wrote perturbation theory, first order. So I said, okay, what do I have here? Let's assume that I only have an impurity at a certain point, the R naught. So now what can happen? I can start either cleanly going from R to R prime, but actually I put them to be one and the same. Okay. So to my Green's function, I will insert at R and extract at R. Or I can go from R to R, but on the way scatter via this impurity. It can happen many times. I can actually go from my STM tip to the impurity and go scatter again in some other impurity and come back. So then I'll have three Green's functions globally. So there are actually more terms which I neglected, and this is called the Born approximation. Now all I did here is I actually Fourier transformed this quantity. And when I Fourier transform, this does not depend on space. Therefore, it will only have a component at q equals 0. This is uniform, let's say, in space. And it's a delicate issue here. Usually, if I have R and R, you can think of a center of mass and a relative coordinate. Here, you only have a center of mass coordinate. So the density of states of a clean system does not depend on the center of mass coordinates, because everything is translationally invariant. So this is my first, and this, when I take the imaginary part, this is going to be just the density of states of the clean system. But here I have a perturbation. And when I Fourier transform, you might remember that a product in real space is a convolution in momentum space, or the other way around. So I get a convolution. So what this tells me is that when I'm looking at a particular momentum, and here it's actually a momentum transfer, how much momentum was transferred by the impurity. So when I Fourier transform, I basically sort out everything by the momentum transfer. So when I look at a particular q, I take any momentum, I need to sum over all of the contributions of processes of the following form. Go from any momentum to k plus or minus q, and actually there's some symmetry, so I calculate for let's say minus q. But the transferred momentum in this was q. Okay, so this is just a single scattering process that takes you from q to k, from k to k minus q, and I have to sum over all processes. And this is what I'm trying to say here, that if I have a contour of constant energy, this is where things are going to come from. Why? Because I know that my Green's function is peak there, right? Here it doesn't tell you to take only on-shell excitations, but I know that there's a strong peak there, so heuristically I can just think of everything as having delta functions that say that the energy has to be omega and has to be conserved in the process. So I can start with any k and go to any k minus q as long as they're on this contour of constant energy. And the other thing I want to say is that when you actually do this integral, you find that not all of these processes have the same strength, and the strongest one is at q that connect these two states on the diameter.
That matrix that comes from real space, right?
This matrix?
Yeah. So now you Fourier transform, you keep this matrix, but I'm just like, G is still the scalar quantity.
G here is a matrix. Okay, so maybe I confused you when I worked with two things. So I wrote everything in 2x2 matrices for graphene. For graphene, I need to write two. If I had just a Fermi liquid, there would be no matrix here. There would be a scalar potential, and this would just be a convolution of two functions. If I want to work in the language of graphene, I can write everything as 2x2 matrices, and then I have to also write the potential in a 2x2 matrix, even though it's just a single impurity, and I get this. Yeah.
This Green's function for clean sample is off-diagonal. It has only off-diagonal non-zero component, right?
Yeah.
The diagonal component.
Oh, only the this one or?
No, the other.
No, it has both diagonal and off-diagonal. So I'll do it in a second.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about the object T naught R minus R, because in quantum field theory, we know that green function of two. The fields at the same point is singular, is not well defined. So is it not problematic in this case here?
No, well, essentially I'm just looking at the perturbation, so there's no worry. Because here,
right.
You know, if I look here, then it's not the same.
Yeah.
In general, there's not usually a problem, because usually you don't need the Green's function to just calculate the density of states. You need it when you start to apply perturbation theory. And then usually you have terms like that, so it's not a problem. So you don't need to regularize it anymore. I think you can always use Feynman diagrams and all of that in condensed matter. And one of the beauties is that you never need to worry about things being infinite. We always have well-defined cutoffs and stuff like that, even for energy. So now, what does the Green's function look like? So this is what it looks like for the Fermi liquid, right? For our graphene system, all we need to do is take the following matrix and invert it. So my Hamiltonian, you remember, was kx plus iky and kx minus iky. Now I need to take the inverse of this matrix minus, so I'm changing all the sides and put the omega here, and this is the matrix I need to invert. Okay? So after many years in grad school, let me just put it, make it imaginary, okay? We can see that diagonal pieces stay diagonal, and these pieces just change their sign. So a 2x2 matrix can be diagonalized. Okay, so this is our Green's function for graphene. And indeed, you know, the meaning that we had before is there, and now you can see the indices that I had there, alpha and beta. If I take the same index, I have inserting and subtracting and extracting an electron with some energy, omega, and momentum k, either on the same sublattice or on different sublattices. And I have amplitudes for both. So now I see that I don't have a lot of time, so let me just maybe quickly move on and just show you results instead of actually doing it. And magically this should appear. Yeah. So basically, you can do it on the lattice and calculate, and all you need to do is convolve Green's functions. But I want you to notice a few things. So this is something I did for graphene, for a single impurity like we discussed. And I have a blob next to Q equals zero. And I have these features here in the corners of the Grignard zone. And actually my function is not periodic with the Grignard zone. It actually has a larger unit cell. So I won't get into that, but this is just a consequence of having two atoms in the same unit cell. And you have this. I wanna look at first this blob.
So I told you before that I expect something that will peak at 2 omega, right? Just based on my Fermi liquid intuition. So what I expected is to see a peak on a circle whose radius is 2 omega. But instead, I don't see that. And if you look here, you'll see basically a cut through the data on the radius starting from zero. And what I find is that if I had a non-chiral system, I would have a huge singularity here at Q equals 2 omega. But instead, when I take the chiral model of graphene, nothing much happens. This is another manifestation of the Klein paradox. Basically, I told you that this peak comes from K goes to minus K. But as we discussed yesterday, that doesn't happen. And the reason that doesn't happen is just because there's no overlap between the wave functions. It's the chirality there is completely opposite. So this just doesn't happen. It's another way of saying the same thing. Or let me just show you. So looking at K and minus K that are just pi apart, and this is the dominant process, I hope to see this huge circle, but instead I just see a blob. And the reason for that, let me just say that I'm taking here 1, 1, because I'm summing over both scattering probing, let's say, on the A sublattice and on the B sublattice. So this is just a sum of two things. And one of them gives me 1, and one gives me exactly e to the I, the angle between these two k states, and so I get I plus e to the I pi, which is 0 in our case. Yeah.
Spin currents in graphene.
Oh, with the impurity. Okay, if you had a one Dirac comb, you can maybe do that. The trouble is, and we're going to get to that in topological insulators, many, many interesting things happen in one Dirac comb. But since we have two Dirac combs with opposite chiralities, all of these beautiful things just cancel. And there are ways that we'll see to actually make this happen, and it happens in topological insulators. Yes. So that's a really nice thought. So basically, this part that I'm writing here, this is just an illustration, it's not a calculation, is telling me that what I wrote here is not enough. I needed to write the graphene Green's function, which would give me some numerators as well.
And the numerators tells me how these Green's functions are actually overlapping. How do the wave functions overlap? So I cannot scatter. This dominant process is just canceled, and I'm left with this blob, which represents basically all of the non-dominant process, things that are not on the shell, things that come from other processes, much weaker. On the other hand, I want to look into inter-valley scattering. So we have two valleys, and I think this is pretty nice, because usually we are not sensitive to chirality. Anything you try to calculate, any thermodynamic property, the pure density of states and all of that does not show you the chirality. But as soon as you add an impurity, you add an interference. So now I have the same dominant process, and I'm taking sigma naught here. So I have one impurity, but I'm probing at two places. And when I do that, I actually get the following thing. So I go from, let's say, the K valley to K minus Q in another valley. Okay, I needed to put that in a different circle here, but I just put them together on the same circle. But in the other valley, the chirality is opposite. So what I have here is e to the minus I phi, k minus q, but phi prime for the other valley. And what I get is that the effective angle between the two vectors, or the two angles, is phi q. So basically, I have some dependence, and this is the one that is relevant to our case. I have some direction dependence. And if you look, if you do it, and you can do it analytically, we wrote everything in Dirac, in the Dirac system. You can do it analytically if you take the starting and the ending Green's functions in with different chirality. So you just change kx to minus kx in one, you reflect the x direction, and you get this kind of process. And if you look at my numerical data, then indeed all of these vectors, so this is a transfer vector that is actually centered around k prime minus k, and you get something that looks like what we calculate analytically, and it of course rotates to preserve the symmetry of the lattice, and this is what you find, and basically there are more features, but basically I think this is two different ways of looking as seeing that we have something different here, that we have the Dirac system. One is that this blob is not a sharp circle like we always expect, and the second is that we have a manifestation of the chirality angle. And actually experiments have been done. Unfortunately, that VQ that we talked about is not that sharp. It's actually a pretty wide distribution. So if we have a Gaussian, we'll have on top of that some envelope here, and the envelope really smears that. I think it's still possible, and I think experiments will at some point reach the point that the samples are clean enough and there's good enough resolution to actually find these patterns too. But experiments actually have been done, this kind of STM experiments, I think maybe about 10 years ago they started to really take off. So it's not only doing STM in high vacuum and all of that, it's also doing it fast enough so that you can scan the sample, but have an atomic resolution scan. And if you can do that fast enough, you get a good size in real space that you can Fourier transform and get good resolution in momentum space and actually see many things. It has also been done in other Dirac systems like the D-wave superconductors, where there actually this chirality angle is related to the Bogliubov-Degen coherence factors. I don't know if you covered that with John. No. So then instead of chirality angle, where the pseudo spin is pointing, you basically know if your quasi-particle wants to be an electron or a hole. So this is a tied to charge that is not a good quantum number in a superconductor. And hopefully it can be done in many other things. Okay, so we didn't do any of the calculations. Maybe we'll do something tomorrow, or maybe we'll just skip on to something else. Any questions? Yeah.
So it's not periodic, it's just around the average, there's two things playing itself. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so basically, let's say that I have a vector that I call a tau to go from A to B. When I write this convolution of Green's function, each one of them has a periodicity of the Green's order, naturally, because that's how I define it. But when I scatter from A to B, I have to add a factor e to the iq tau, because I have an extra step which is inside the Brillouin zone, inside the unit zone. And e to the iq tau, since tau is smaller
then a lattice vector does not cancel, even if Q is already a reciprocal lattice vector. So what I'm left with is an extra factor every time Q becomes, let's say, crosses the Brillouin zone boundary. I just get an extra factor of e to the I tau times reciprocal lattice vector, which is actually not
2 pi. It's more like 2 pi over 3. And that's why I get a unit cell that is 3 times bigger than the Brillouin zone. So this is actually 3 times bigger. You can draw more pieces of this hexagon inside. Yeah. Okay, more?
Okay, so if not, I'll see you again tomorrow. And I just want to remind you, if you have questions, if you want to discuss things, Dennis and I are here. I'm sometimes here on the third floor. If I'm not here, I might be in 361 in the middle.